from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
And affirmative action is essentially a kind of tax that consumers pay that acts as reparations to black employees. And it's been going on for 50 years.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. And that's Dr. Paul Marino, Chair in Constitutional History, Professor of History, and Dean of Social Sciences at Hillsdale College. Dr. Marino, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Talking with you about this piece you wrote recently for Real Clear Policy at realclearpolicy.com. 50 years of reparations, and this deals with the revived discussion of reparations for slavery and segregation. The House, in fact, passed a bill, or advanced a bill recently, to form a committee on reparations. You say at the start here, and we'll return to this, but you argue we've had reparations in the form of affirmative action for the past half century, for 50 years. I want to come back to that, but first, I want to talk about the history of affirmative action. Where does that term even originate?
Well, it actually it came about first in the National Labor Relations Act, the Wagner Act, which was an anti-discrimination law in itself. It was made it illegal to discriminate against labor organizers or labor union members. And if an employer did that, he would be forced to reinstate the employee, give him back pay, and any other quote-unquote affirmative action that the board might require. That could be things like posting notices in the workplace that you were free to unionize, doing something for the labor organization, but that was up to the administrative body. Then it came up in the anti-discrimination realm in 1961. President John F. Kennedy issued an executive order, as every previous president going back to FDR had, saying that if you did business with the federal government, if you were a federal contractor, you couldn't discriminate on the basis of race or creed or color or national origin were the original terms. And Kennedy was the first one to say you had to do more than that. You were required to take affirmative action to implement the goals of the order. So he sort of brought that term from labor law into anti-discrimination policy. And originally it meant things like, recruiting at historically black colleges, mm-hmm. advertising in black newspapers, sort of breaking down the old boys network by which most recruiting took place. This came to be referred to as soft affirmative action. You just let people know that the door, the gates were open. It was something more than just not discriminating, but it wasn't about a certain number, a statistical quota of a group that you had to have.
Let's roll back a few decades from Kennedy. When did the federal government begin to prohibit racial discrimination in employment?
Apart from state governments, and some of these predated the federal government, FDR, President Franklin Roosevelt, in 1941, when the government was getting ready to mobilizing for World War II, A. Philip Randolph, who was a much forgotten civil rights leader, he was the head of the all-black sleeping car porters union and a civil rights activist. And he was organizing a march on Washington. They were going to bring either 10,000 or 100,000 blacks to protest discrimination in defense contracting. Blacks weren't getting the good jobs as the federal government was spending money on rearming. And also to desegregate the military. He had Jim Crow and all the armed services. And so FDR made a deal with them. He told Randolph, I'll issue an order that forbids discrimination in contracting, but we'll put off integrating the military because the military brass was opposed to that. That didn't happen until 1948 with President Truman. So Roosevelt issued an order for saying, if you're doing business with the federal government, you can't discriminate against blacks. Even ironically, you couldn't discriminate against Japanese Americans. Hmm. Even at the time they were being interned, if you couldn't turn them away if they applied for a job.
Talking with Dr. Paul Marino about his piece at realclearpolicy.com, 50 years of reparations. So where and how does the Civil Rights Act of 1964 sort of fit into all of this?
It came right in the middle. President Kennedy called for a congressional permanent act that would apply to all employers, not just government contractors, but technically anybody who is doing business in interstate commerce, but that applies, that includes just about everybody. Kennedy didn't actually call for that in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but when he called for ending segregation in, hotels and restaurants and things like that, education, liberal members of Congress introduced an FEPC, a fair employment provision. It became Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Kennedy was assassinated in the midst of this. It was being filibustered in the Senate, And Johnson came to the rescue. He was the master of the Senate. He was the one who actually got the job done, was able to overcome the Southern filibuster and got Title VII enacted. So this made it essentially apply to all employers. You can't discriminate on the basis of race, creed, color, national origin. Other things have been added to it. It had no affirmative action language in the statute, and it had several provisions that forbade racial proportionalism, saying that statistics don't prove discrimination, preferential treatment is not required. There were certain things to make it foolproof because racial quotas were so unpopular. The other surprise in it was it added sex. For the first time, it was illegal to discriminate on the basis of sex, not gender. That word appears nowhere in any legislation. And the story goes that Southern opponents of the bill tried to slip that in to make it so unpalatable that it would be voted down. But to their surprise, it was voted up. And in the long run, it's really more important than the race prohibition.
Hmm. As happens after we have these rules and regulations, they become litigated through courts. You point to this case, this Weber case at the Supreme Court in 1979 as being important. What was the precedent there?
Yeah, well, the first one was Griggs in 1971, and this was the 50th anniversary of that case that caused me to write the piece. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission essentially devised a statistical definition of discrimination. It's called the disparate impact standard, basically saying that we assume that there has been discrimination if there's a disproportion in the number of minorities who can pass an exam or who are hired or who are not promoted or something like that. And when the court, when this definition was challenged in 1971, the court accepted the commission's interpretation of this, and that was the beginnings of affirmative action in under Title VII. And employers got the message that if you reach your quota or something approximating it, usually the EEOC will accept 80% of the number that you should have. They'll leave you alone. And so they voluntarily adopted affirmative action plans. The Weber case in 1979 shielded companies that had affirmative action plans against challenges from whites or other groups, so-called reverse discrimination suits.
Dr. Paul Marino, now that we know a bit about the history, let's come back to your thesis statement here. 50 years of reparations, you say, the fact of the matter is we've had reparations in the form of affirmative action for the past half century. So why do you say that?
Yeah, this is the way that economists have analyzed this. And the reason why employers were willing to accept affirmative action was they understood that even if we have to hire, not on the basis of merit, if we have to hire minority workers who are less productive, who are less efficient, but the cost of that is less than being challenged in lawsuits, then the bottom line is all that profit-making, maximizing corporations care about. They said, we can do that. We want something that is predictable, something that, we can institutionalize. And corporations, especially the big ones, have, personnel offices and diversity offices and things like that, so that they know that they are in compliance. Hmm. And they realized they were safer under a race-conscious regime where as long as they get the numbers right, they'll know what the bottom line is than under a, haphazard, potentially explosive regime of litigation.
So the reparations that you talk about come in the form of the economic opportunities and the money that literally is flowing in that direction because of affirmative action.
The cost, to some degree, you're shifting benefits from, qualified white workers who don't get jobs to less qualified black workers who do. But mostly the cost is passed on to the consumer. Business is less efficient because of affirmative action. But again, and we've seen this with regard to so many other things with regard to corporations in terms of tax collection.
Right.
They don't collect they just collect the taxes. They don't pay them. They just pass them on to the consumers. And affirmative action is essentially a kind of tax that consumers pay that acts as reparations to black employees. And it's been going on for 50 years.
Dr. Paul Marino, you can find his piece at realclearpolicy.com, 50 Years of Reparations. He's the William and Bernice Grucock Chair in Constitutional History, Professor of History, and Dean of Social Sciences at Hillsdale College.
If I'd like to just add one thing. This is not an original idea on my part. If anyone's seen the very funny movie Barbershop, Cedric the Entertainer makes exactly this point in that. He says we've had reparations for 50 years.
Dr. Marino, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Up next, Andrew Klavan from the Daily Wire is with us. He'll tell us all about his brand new book, The Emperor's Sword. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We say hello to our listeners on WAIM, 1230 AM in Anderson, South Carolina. Thank you for listening to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined now by Andrew Klavan. You can find him on Twitter at Andrew Klavan. He is the host of The Andrew Klavan Show over at The Daily Wire and author of the recent book, The Emperor's Sword, the finale of a trilogy we'll talk about here in a moment. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us.
A pleasure, Scott.
So The Emperor's Sword, I mentioned it's the end of a trilogy, and I know, though, we're talking to some people who might not have read the first two books. So what can we tell them that won't ruin their enjoyment of the first two while also enticing them to read the third?
All right. Well, the trilogy is called Another Kingdom, and it's about a kind of failed screenwriter who one day walks through the door and finds himself in this kind of magical semi-medieval world where he's been accused of murder. And ever since then, he has been flashing back and forth between this bizarre fantasy world and the LA of the present. And he finds in both places he is hunted and wanted by very dangerous people, and that somehow these two stories, the story in one world and the story in the real world, have been coming together into one story. And then the Emperor's Sword resolves those two stories.
Now, it's not too much to tell people that at the beginning of this third book, The Emperor's Sword, Austin Lively is a successful Hollywood screenwriter. So there's lots of discussion about that the price you pay to reach your dreams. How does that theme sort of become relevant in the course of the story?
Well, you know, it's a funny thing about Hollywood. I worked in Hollywood for quite some time, and people want it so desperately that they start out just wanting to tell stories, just wanting to be part of an industry that produces things that give people entertainment and joy. And a lot of times they end up with their soul on a platter being passed around a bunch of executives who wouldn't know a good story if it bit them on the leg. And it really is a terrible thing that the business does to people so often. I used to joke that I was the only happy screenwriter I ever met, and the reason I was happy is because I was basically a novelist, so I always had these stories that I had complete control over, and I didn't owe anything to the movie business. I did it when it was fun. I did it, you know, for interest. But other people really would sell their soul to be in this business and do sell their soul. And so, like, it's a strange combination of people who really have talent, who really want to entertain, who really are here to do something worthwhile, and yet end up getting chewed up by this machine that is making stories at a cost of so many millions of dollars that basically the storyteller's art gets lost in the commercial art. And that's been true of Hollywood forever, and in some ways it has made it a very good metaphor for some of the more extreme capitalism in America, some of the costs of living a purely capitalist life.
You've talked for a long time, Andrew Klavan, about the left's dominance of culture and entertainment. And certainly that's still a very relevant theme today. But we do see, I don't know, a slight shift. When we look at the ratings now, for a long time it didn't seem to matter, but now the ratings are cratering for the Oscars and the celebration of movies and the Grammys and the celebration of music and the NBA and the celebration of sport. Will people actually tuning away and stop paying attention to these entities, is that what's going to lead to change?
Well, this is a really fascinating thing. It's especially fascinating for people who don't believe in original sin, okay? Because here is an industry that once strode across the world, sending American messages and American stories to everyone around the world. This is the industry that produced Gone with the Wind and Citizen Kane and the great John Ford westerns and very iconic American art that really was held up to everyone around the world as a beautiful vision of America. And now it is this obscure, virtue signaling, prideful, hectoring, lecturing group of virtual unknowns who sit around and give each other awards on ceremonies that nobody watches. And all they have to do is start telling great stories again and stop telling us, giving us moral lectures. And they can't do it. It is so important to them to signal their virtue. It is so important to them to pretend to be better people than they are that they are actually willing to destroy the entire industry to go woke and to show us how woke they are. people will not buy this stuff because it's not true, it's not entertaining, it's not even vaguely interesting, but they can't stop doing it. It's an amazing thing. It's kind of, you know, it's kind of like the way they make these leftist movies or these anti-American movies that nobody sees, mm-hmm. and then give each other awards for them, and all anybody wants to watch are the Marvel comic book movies. It's an amazing destruction of an industry in the name of pretending to be virtuous. And it really shows you how compelled people are to try and prove their virtue.
Andrew Klavan with us, a recent book, The Emperor's Sword, the end of the trilogy, with Austin Lively and other characters that you have created and made these homes and environments for them. You're putting Austin Lively to bed now with the third part of the trilogy. Do you ever feel with your past characters the need to extend their stories? Do you look back and wonder if there are more adventures for these characters that you've created in your works?
You know, I sometimes do. There, every now and again, I have the urge to go back and rewrite one of my books, not using the knowledge that I've gained over the years. You know, but I am a believer that stories begin and end. You know, I'm a believer that a story is a journey that a person takes, maybe the one journey that he could take that would change him and that would reach in to expose him and show us what he's made of. And so I don't like to just go on and on because something is working or because it's successful. I really want to bring a story to a conclusion. Now, this is a story with a lot of different parts and mm-hmm. with a lot of different aspects and people who go off in different directions. So there's room to come back to it and tell a new story about it, and that might be kind of interesting. But right now, for now, I'm moving on to other things.
Andrew Klavan, also the host of the Andrew Klavan Show over at The Daily Wire. When you were a guest up here at Hillsdale College, you were doing it every day. We helped pull that off here in our studios. Now, one day a week, just on Fridays for the Andrew Klavan Show, what does that shift mean for you and the show?
Well, it has been great. I mean, I have to say that it was very tough because I write so many other things and do so many other things, it was very tough for me to maintain the quality that I wanted doing the show 4 days a week. And for a long time, I kept it going. And then toward the end of the Trump administration, I just started to get tired, and I could hear myself on the edge of getting tired. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to stop this and refresh the show. And I'm really happy with the results, and the audience seems to be really happy with it. I do a longer show now once a week on Friday. I do much deeper dives. I get to talk more about the culture and about philosophy and religion than I did before, and I'm really happy with it. You know, the problem for me with talking about politics day by day is you have to make a big deal out of every petty little squabble that comes up between the Republicans and the Democrats. And that is essentially giving people a false picture, because so many of these squabbles just disappear and kind of evaporate. And you make a big deal out of them, and then 3 days later, nobody remembers them again. And that didn't feel honest to me. I wanted to do something where I could say, here are the trends, here are the big picture ideas, here are the ideas that are in play. It just seemed more worthwhile. And the audience seems to agree with me, which is really gratifying.
Andrew Klavan, author of the recent book, The Emperor's Sword. You can find the other two parts of the trilogy as well, Another Kingdom and The Nightmare Feast, where fine books are sold. And also check out The Andrew Klavan Show over at The Daily Wire. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Always a pleasure, Scott. Thanks.
Up next, it's Dr. Tom Treloar from Hillsdale's Mathematics Department talking about math as part of a liberal arts education. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's the Ramsey Show. Talk radio where debt is dumb and cash is king. Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
Slow down. Hi, this is Dr. Trudy Pratt. My chiropractic and nutrition practice in downtown Reading has been helping people feel better for over 20 years. We pride ourselves in really listening to our patients and then tailoring a program of nutrition, chiropractic care, massage, and exercise that's just right for you. The results can be dramatic. Call 244-7873. That's 244-7873. Thank you.
Did you know that the City of Reading has started licensing commercial cannabis activities within the city limits? Synergy is the first of the city's approved retailers to obtain licensure, bringing to the Reading area the most experienced retailer in the North State. They will ensure that your visit is both professional and comfortable. Access is simple and discreet. Synergy has a private 25-space parking lot at the back of the building. Synergy is located at 345 Hempstead Drive, Reading.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans' issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5, 1460 AM.
Where do you go in Shasta County to get advice on the best type of firearm to meet your needs and how to safely carry and use it? The answer is to join the revolution at locally owned Bastiani Arms. Bastiani Arms believes in a better way to serve their customers and providing them with all the information needed to make the right decisions before and after the sale. They have a large selection of guns and ammunition and always special discounts for veterans. Self-protection is your right. Join the revolution at Bastiani Arms, 2539 Larkspur Lane in Reading, 222-8222.
Hi, my name's Nick Gardner. I have a show here on KCNR, Sunday mornings from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. every other Sunday. The name of my show is Poke the Hornet's Nest.
There's no mountain I can't climb. There's no tower too high. No plane that I can't learn how to fly. What do I gotta do to get through to you to show you there ain't nothing I can't take this chainsaw to?
I'm going to concentrate on local politics mainly, but we'll talk about national politics also. You'll get the view of the common citizen here in Redding, California. And remember, today is the first day of the rest of your life. Maybe it's a good time for a new perspective about what's been going on in our town, in our state, in our nation. I hope you tune in and hear the other side of the news.
Everybody, listen up! KCNR, 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and hear us online at kcnr1460.com. Don't miss Armstrong and Getty, plus Ben Shapiro, and Free Fire Radio with Carl and Linda Bott, featuring special guests talking about local issues on KCNR.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of this program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by Dr. Thomas Treloar, Chairman and Professor of Mathematics at Hillsdale College. Dr. Treloar, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We're talking about the study of mathematics here in this conversation, and you can find a recent online course at online.hillsdale.edu, Mathematics and Logic from Euclid to Modern Geometry. That's available for you. When we talk about the study of mathematics, though, how would you describe the role of mathematics in the liberal arts?
At a fundamental level, you could think about mathematics, and many people often do, as a language. Right? It's a language where we take, at least initially, real-world objects, and we abstract them. Right? So when we're talking about two houses, or two birds, or two candy bars, or two, right, there's this notion of two-ness.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's this notion of number, there's this notion of quantity, and we try to understand the relationship between those quantities. Right? There's a very simple example of how math as a language describes something. And as we build math up, we oftentimes develop that language in such a way that we can describe more complicated phenomenon. Right? So fundamentally, we can think of it as a language, but it's not just a language, right? Or maybe said another way, some languages are better at making certain arguments than others, right? The vocabulary that is there to do so.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we can use mathematics as a way to think, as a way to organize our thoughts, a way to put arguments together to form more complicated arguments or to develop more complicated truths.
I think some students along the way at some point perhaps ask themselves the question about the purpose of studying things like geometry. Perhaps you hear, when am I ever going to use this, or why do I have to know this? Why is geometry an integral part of a liberal arts education?
I'd say the fundamental thing about geometry in particular is that we very clearly state at the beginning of the geometry study what we're going to assume to be true. And then we talk about logic and reasoning and how we're going to make arguments. And so one thing you can think about in terms of geometry is how do I use my support material to make an argument?
Mm-hmm.
How do I use my first principles or the things that I know are already true to make an argument? This is learned, right? This is not something that we naturally do, or at least naturally do well. We need to develop those skills. And this is just the way, this is not the way that geometry is taught often these days. Back in the early 90s, the National Council for Teachers of Mathematics put out recommendations for changes to high school curriculum, and one of them was to move away from a proof-based geometry course.
Hmm.
Fortunately, I graduated prior to that, so I feel like I had a good two-column proof geometry course at that time, but they moved away from that.
So I, like you, still had the proof-based geometry teaching when I was in high school, but for many of our listeners who also probably had the same experience, how did it change? I mean, how is geometry taught in many places these days?
Now, initially it was changed slightly, but now it's oftentimes taught very quantitatively. Rather than sort of understanding the relationship between lines and triangles and things like this and proving things along the way, oftentimes it's very formulaic. Like the area of a square is the side length squared. You know, the area of a triangle is 1/2 base times height, right? So it's just this memorization of formulas that treats math as a bunch of disparate facts that must be memorized, as opposed to a body of knowledge that fits together if we're just willing to put that time and energy into understanding how that happens.
Talking with Dr. Thomas Treloar, Chairman and Professor of Mathematics here at Hillsdale College, about the study of mathematics. Is there a proper order in the study of mathematics?
Yeah, so if you think about mathematics, and going back to the earlier question, as a language, for instance, you know, if you think about how we order our mathematics instruction, we start with young children with arithmetic. And what is arithmetic but the abstraction of quantity? And we move there to addition and subtraction, right? Which we should be able to think of those as sort of real world problems initially that we then abstract. And I have John has two apples and Jane has three apples. They have together five apples. Is a 2 + 3 = 5? And so when we start training young kids, we should start training them. We're training them in mathematics in a way of taking the concrete and generalizing it to the abstract. And then we're trying to understand the relationship then at this abstract level, because as we do that, it helps us understand what's happening in the real world. So we spend a good bit of time on that. From at least kindergarten through sixth grade, we're dealing with arithmetic. And then, of course, as we go through, algebra, right? And algebra is oftentimes thought of as a generalization of arithmetic, right? We're really trying to dig in a little bit deeper into mm-hmm. the first principles of arithmetic and understand how all that fits together. And from algebra, we go to geometry, where we put aside quantity for a little while, at least if we're doing it correctly. We're putting aside quantity for a while, and we're just dealing with these more fundamental things. And the nice thing about geometry at that point is we can stop. We can build up a body of knowledge that is somewhat separate, but of course it does fit together from mm-hmm. everything else. And we can do that, and it helps us, right? Just like learning a new language helps us understand our own language better.
Right.
Learning the language of geometry will help us understand algebra better. And then algebra goes to algebra 2, which is the marriage of algebra and geometry. And I'll say, proper ordering is at some point along the way there, we usually make it to calculus, at least in this day and age. And it's a pretty natural progression of all of these things.
Hillsdale has a math course as part of the core curriculum here and has for about a decade or so. It's called Mathematics and deductive reasoning. What are its aims, and what are the things that you want every Hillsdale student to have experienced in the mathematics world through that course?
The fundamental thing that we would like them to experience is this idea of taking our self-evident truths, our first principles, and building them up into a body of knowledge. We designed the course in that way, and we used Euclid's Elements to do that because Euclid did such a wonderful job at of doing that. Start with as few assumptions as possible. How many things can you build from that?
Mm-hmm.
So more than anything else, we want to be able to do that. We want to get students away from this idea that you should use your math class as a bunch of memorization, which is oftentimes taught that way. We wanted to move it away from algebra because high school mathematics has such a heavy influence into algebra.
Right.
And there are certain students who enjoy and appreciate algebra, but there's a good number of students who do not. And in particular, humanities students oftentimes dislike algebra, but they can at least somewhat, hopefully, remember fondly, oh, I enjoyed my geometry class.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a couple of things that were at play in all of this to try to keep prerequisites down because people come into Hillsdale College with a wide variety of backgrounds. But we wanted to do that, so we picked geometry as the course, and we very much appreciate it. I think the students have also.
Dr. Thomas Treloar, Chairman and Professor of Mathematics at Hillsdale College, and an online course at online.hillsdale.edu, Mathematics and Logic from Euclid to Modern Geometry. Dr. Treloar, thanks for joining us on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, new Hillsdale graduate Reagan Meyer will join us to talk about a piece she wrote about Elizabeth Smith Friedman, a fellow Hillsdale graduate. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Did you know that the City of Reading has started licensing commercial cannabis activities within the city limits? Synergy is the first of the city's approved retailers to obtain licensure, bringing to the Reading area the most experienced retailer in the North State. They will ensure that your visit is both professional and comfortable. Access is simple and discreet. Synergy has a private 25-space parking lot at the back of the building. Synergy is located at 345 Hempstead Drive, Reading.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. For this month, we're reviewing Arturo Fuente's Hemingway Classic. With curves of a supermodel, this Perfecto has a superbly balanced, toothy, and attenuated Cameroon wrapper and pairs exquisitely with a complex filler and binder that indulges the palate with citrus, coffee, cocoa, and cedar. Come down to the shop for your Arturo Fuente Hemingway Classic today, 2143 Hilltop Drive, Reading.
Hi, this is Dr. Patricia Bay, and my radio show, Therapy in a Nutshell, which airs on Saturdays at 11 a.m. on KCNR, 1460 a.m., or 96.5 FM, is a great show for you to listen to and learn how to effectively change your life. We talk about issues such as communication and trust, couples issues, and many more. Also, you can listen to the radio show on my podcast through the Anchor app, which is free and safe. Or you can tune into the iTunes or Spotify podcast and listen to it there. It's a nice show that'll help you throughout the day and throughout your life. So join me for Therapy in a Nutshell, Saturdays, 11 a.m. at KCNR Radio. This is Dr. Patricia Bay, trying to heal the world 1 hour at a time.
You get me every time.
What is a hero? A hero serves when no one else is ready to. A hero helps everyone, never asking for any praise. They stand ready to do whatever is needed. They have picked up the mantle of heroism when we have needed it the most, and their tireless dedication can never be appreciated enough. We want to thank all of our local heroes. We could not get through these times without their courage. We thank you for everything that you do.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To find out more about Hillsdale College for prospective students, for alumni, or friends of Hillsdale, head to hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Reagan Meyer, a senior at Hillsdale College, rhetoric and public address major, journalism minor, and also author of a piece recently about Elizabeth Smith Friedman. Reagan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Talking about Elizabeth Smith Friedman, not a name, perhaps, that is on the tip of everyone's tongue. Who was Elizabeth Smith Friedman? Why should we know more about her?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, it's a name that everyone should know, in my opinion. Elizabeth Smith Friedman was a cryptologist or cryptoanalyst in the 1900s, early 20th century, and she was responsible for originating the code or the field of code breaking, and more importantly, bringing down the Nazi regime in South America during World War II.
What is her Hillsdale connection? Because I know she has one.
Yeah, so she graduated from Hillsdale College in 1915 with a major in English literature. She was a member of the Pi Beta Phi sorority chapter here, which is actually part of the reason I know about her, because, you know, we like that history. So, yeah, she graduated, and she's a Hillsdale alumnus.
So how, you mentioned she brought down the Nazis and stuff, right? How did she get involved, first of all, in cryptology?
Right, okay, so she graduates from Hillsdale, goes to teach at this school in Indiana, doesn't like teaching, goes and moves home with her parents. But her whole thing throughout her life was she didn't want to be normal. Her parents were Quakers. She was the youngest of nine children. She didn't want to be normal. She moved to Chicago to get a job. And at the library in Chicago, she spoke to this librarian about the fact that she was fascinated with Shakespeare. And there was a man with the last name of Fabian who had this like utopian scientific community called Riverbank Laboratories, and he was fascinated with Shakespeare. And the library knew about him, and so she said, why don't I connect the two of you? And apparently this guy just showed up in his limousine one night and just picked her up, which is very weird, like, to us now. Like, you wouldn't do that now. Back then it worked. And she ended up at this job at Riverbank Laboratories, and the Shakespeare connection comes in here because she really first got into cryptology by cracking whether or not Shakespeare was actually the author of Shakespeare's works.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how she really got into it. And then she met her husband there as well, and they together originated the field of code breaking.
Shakespeare, before we move on, what was the question and what was the answer she came up with?
Right, so there was this debate for years about if this other person, which I can't remember the name, had written Shakespeare's works instead of Shakespeare, but, you know, and there's still debate today about who Shakespeare really was. And she went in with her husband, fiance at the time, and they just went through and compared all of these writings and Shakespeare's letters to Shakespeare's works and determined there was no way that William Shakespeare had not written William Shakespeare's plays.
Talking with Reagan Meyer, senior here at Hillsdale College. She has a piece over at Evie Magazine, which is EVIEmagazine.com, on Elizabeth Smith Friedman. When it comes to code breaking, again, how did she enter into that sort of realm, and what were her accomplishments there?
So William, her husband, got into it in the first World War, I believe. And he was in Europe doing all this code-breaking stuff, and she actually stayed at Riverbank Laboratories for some time. And then she ended up in D.C. with him. And if I remember correctly, she became the first woman in the Coast Guard, because they originated the field of code-breaking in the Coast Guard. She became the first woman to lead, like, a Coast Guard unit. And she and her husband just trained all of these people, because they knew towards the end of World War I that this field was going to be immensely important, mm-hmm. as they moved into the 20th century. And it did end up being that way. Her accomplishments, we talk about World War II, but her accomplishments otherwise were incredible as well.
What was her particular skill at code breaking? Why was she better than the others?
She just was good at it. They tried to explain it because there is a documentary out about her that came out on PBS in January, and they explain it. It's very confusing, like how my brain doesn't work this way. But she was just very good at picking out certain patterns. Some people's brains are just programmed to pick out certain patterns and to look and to see the sequences and the codes, and she was just good at it. I mean, that's like the only explanation I've found, is that she just had a natural talent for this stuff.
Your piece over at EV Magazine tries to answer the question, what Elizabeth Smith Friedman can teach the modern woman. What's your analysis of that?
Sure. So I think she's very interesting because we're currently in a very hyper-feminist society, very much like, just have a career, don't have any children, all these things. And she, I guess, looking back then, would have been considered that, like, the hyper-feminist of time, because she was originating a field and she was working in a male-dominant field and she wasn't at home with her kids and all of these things. But she was really such an incredibly well-rounded individual. Like, she and her husband were married for 50-plus years, I think. I mean, and they were together and in love and dedicated to each other. She was a mother, had children. So she did all of these incredible things in her personal life as well as her professional life, which I don't think we celebrate anymore, and I think we should. And I think the other thing that's really important is she pursued her passions, and she pursued what she loved. We talk a lot about, like, you just need to make money, you just need to get a job, and you just need to, like, exist. It seems to kind of be the MO of today. And instead, she just saw what she wanted and what she loved, and she went for it. And I don't think she set out to be, like, the one that took down, like, the South American Nazi ring. I don't think she set out to do that. I think she just set out to be a really good crypto analyst because that's what she loved, and that's what she ended up doing. So I think really the biggest thing from that piece is, I think if young women, and I mean young men too, but I think she's a very good role model for young women, can just look at, like, just follow what you love. And if you follow what you love, you'll do great things because you love it, not because you were supposed to do those great things, if that makes sense.
Sure. What kind of obstacles did she overcome in her career? How did she stay so resilient through those years?
Well, so she was in a male-dominated field. And actually, J. Edgar Hoover took credit for all of her work. So the reason you don't know her name is because she wasn't allowed to say anything until she died. I think she died in 1988, I believe, 1980. She just wasn't allowed to say anything. So she had all of these accomplishments, and then we didn't get to take any credit for it. And the other thing that was a big obstacle was her husband was the head of, I think he was the head of all of the, like, big crypto analyst communications and breaking in Europe during World War II, and he actually suffered a nervous breakdown in the mid-1940s. And so her entire life after that was taking care of him and his depression, which at times was so bad she would have to, like, put her hand over his hand and, like, help him write so that he could start to write, because he was so depressed that he couldn't even get his hand moving to write words on the page. And I think she stayed so resilient because she just was a resilient person. I mean, look at everything she did over her life, and she had to be strong to do what she did. Because the mental toll that knowing, like, if I don't break this code, people will die. I mean, you have to be a strong-willed person and a mentally strong person to deal with that.
Talking with Reagan Meyer, her piece at EV Magazine, EVIEmagazine.com, on Elizabeth Smith Friedman, a Hillsdale graduate. Speaking of, are there any records or any remembrances of her achievements while she was here at Hillsdale?
That's a good question. There are some pictures, and there's actually a picture in the documentary, which they don't talk about the fact that she went here and the legacy. I think the important thing to remember is that Hillsdale admitted men and women equally long before anybody else did, and if it hadn't existed, Elizabeth Smith Friedman might not have, which is, like, I think, an important thing that we should all know. But I have not found anything specifically. There are a couple pictures, though, in the digital archives online, if you are curious.
Reagan Meyer, senior here at Hillsdale College, rhetoric and public address major, journalism minor, and her piece at evmagazine.com, E-V-I-E, on World War II codebreaker Elizabeth Smith Friedman, what she can teach the modern woman, this Hillsdale graduate achieving great things. Reagan, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you for having me.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Dr. Paul Marino, talking about 50 years of reparations, his recent piece at realclearpolicy.com. Andrew Clavin told us about his recent book, The Emperor's Sword. We talked with Tom Treloar about mathematics as part of a liberal arts education. And finally, very recent graduate Reagan Meyer told us all about Elizabeth Smith Friedman. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. You can follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or on Facebook. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. The assistant producer of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is Nate Esbenshade. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. In response to COVID-19, NFI has scheduled online Zoom classroom sessions for CCW and CCW renewal. These online courses will be followed up with live fire range training, which will complete your certification. Follow-on range training is done with the same great instructors you've come to know and love. Give us a call today at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Hey, guys, I'm Bob the Drop. Welcome to my podcast. Do you like water? If you do, you're going to love me. I'm pure and simple. I'm talking refreshing. Yeah. Spent 500 years in a glacier before it was that cold. I never was and never will be tap water. Nope. Bottled at the source, the base of Mount Shasta. Yep, pure and simple. Naturally the best. You can try me by calling 1-800-922-6227. Mount Shasta Spring Water.
Hi, this is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
These are unprecedented times, challenging how the YMCA works to strengthen community as we have for nearly 170 years. But we've always found ways to help people and communities in times of crisis. Right now, Ys across the country are providing emergency child care, shelter, food programs, and outreach to seniors. But we can't do it alone. Whether you're connected to the Y or have a fond Y memory, we need you to stay with us. Reach out to your local Y today and stay with us for a better us.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Then Goliath, a Philistine champion from Gath, came out of the Philistine ranks to face the forces of Israel. He was over 9 feet tall. He wore a bronze helmet, and his bronze coat of mail weighed 125 pounds. 1 Samuel chapter 17.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses. And today we are talking about basically just people, but magically bigger people.
That would be the giants. Now, we're not talking about Andre the Giant giants, not people who are just incredibly tall. We are talking about actual mythical creatures, legends, tales of races of tall people.
Across the world, a lot of cultures show tall people as powerful people. I believe there are two different Shinto emperors who are reported to have been more than 10 feet tall. So at first sight, if your hero is encountering a giant, they can be very intimidated without even talking to or encountering physically.
So when we're talking about these mythical giants, the biggest thing about them in most legends is that they're basically people, but big. They are sometimes slower, less intelligent, but always strong.
And I've found cannibalism is something that we see a lot of, or at least eating humans in some way. You know, grind your bones for bread kind of a mantra. We see that in a couple of different giant stories around the world.
I have a hard time siding with Jack on the Jack and the Beanstalk story. What would you do if somebody invaded your house and stole your stuff?
Probably exactly the same thing.
So let's get into some examples of giant or large, intimidating, strong creatures. Of course, you have your trolls and your ogres and your orcs.
A lot of the references to giants are an alternate race, similar to elves and dwarves, where they are human-like, but not. They aren't exactly gods. They aren't demonic in any way. They're mostly just a different kind of people.
In Norse mythology, you have the Jotuns.
And to be clear, the Avengers mythology as well.
Of course, the frost giants from Jotunheim are very based on this race of giants in Norse mythology.
There was a carving that was dated to about the 10th century AD of, I'm not going to try to pronounce her name because I'm going to butcher it, but one of the Jotun riding a dog, like a horse, might have been a wolf. And she had, like, reins on it, but the reins were made of snakes. It was a very interesting depiction of, because most of the time when we see giants, we don't see them using tools in that kind of a sophisticated way. It's mostly like a club and smash Harry Potter in the bathroom. And, of course, heading south to the Middle East, the Judeo-Christian history, we have the Philistines, which our opener was referencing, these gigantic warrior-type people.
Even if you aren't super familiar with the Judeo-Christian beliefs, you likely have heard the term Goliath. You've heard that and know that it references a giant, a huge human that is not easily defeated. So if we want to go down under to Australia, there is an oral tradition of a giant known as Crooked Mick.
If you're listening from the U.S., you probably know who Paul Bunyan is. Crooked Mick is like Paul Bunyan, but cooler. Not only does he like chop down stuff and shear sheep and such, but he makes great pies, apparently.
Not only are his pies good, but they are light, so light that a gust of wind can carry them away. And not only are pies getting carried away, if he kicks a crocodile, he can send it to the moon. I love this, and it's just so much fun that you've just got this, like, Australian bushman that's going out there kicking crocodiles and baking pies.
So you want to look that one up? That's Crooked Mick.
And then, of course, you have a giant that is super familiar because of its prominence in Greek and Roman tradition, and that's the Cyclops.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.